Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, a monthly series from the American Writers Museum that aims to explore our ever-growing nation of writers by examining powerful and significant American voices throughout history. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our forthcoming virtual exhibit, American Voices. In honor of Native American Heritage Month, today we're learning more about Sequoia.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Nation of Writers. Today we will learn more about Sequoia, who developed the written form of the Cherokee language, bringing literacy to the Cherokee Nation. My name is Nate King, and I'm the Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum in Chicago. Joining me from Oklahoma today is Kristen Moser, Cultural Collections and Exhibits Manager at Cherokee Nation Cultural Tourism, one of the museums that they manage is Sequoia's Cabot Museum. And Kristen is a descendant of Sequoia herself. Kristen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yeah. So to start off, can you tell me a little bit about Sequoia's Cabin Museum and your work for the Cherokee Nation Cultural Tourism?
Yes. So Sequoia's Cabin was built in 1829 by Sequoia himself. He cut all of the logs himself, and it's a one-room cabin. And it actually stayed in his possession in his family's possession until 1855, when his widow sold it to another Cherokee family. And it stayed with that family until 1936, when it was deeded to the state of Oklahoma to be used as a memorial for Sequoia. And so I think that it's really neat that it, up until its time being operated by the state, it stayed in Cherokee hands. So the state operated it as a memorial and later a museum from 1936 to 2016, when Cherokee Nation took over operation of it. So that was a very exciting time for us to reacquire it and get to go in and update the interpretive materials and everything.
Yeah, that is great. Earlier today, I did the virtual tour of that space. That was really fun.
Yes, yes. It's really unique. I can't show you any pictures, but it's really unique because the structure is within a structure now. In 1936, the Historical Society applied for a grant to build a structure around the cabin to preserve it. And so it has a WPA stone structure surrounding the cabin. So it's really neat because you go inside a building to look inside another building.
That is great. And obviously better for preservation, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. So it is a National Historic Landmark, and it's on the National Register of Historic Places, and it's also an American Library Association Literary Landmark.
Great, yeah. So what can you tell me a little bit about Sequoia? As far as, I mean, he's got a whole life of stories.
It's really unusual because for somebody who is so famous, there's actually not as much known about him as you would think, because most of his earlier life was spent before the Cherokee had a written language to record these things. So we believe he was born sometime around 1765 to 1775, somewhere in there. He was born in the lower Appalachian region of what is now Tennessee. He was raised by a single mother. He was, I guess you would say he was lame. He had some issues with one of his legs, although historians haven't been able to really pinpoint if he was born with some type of disability or if that was something that maybe happened in a hunting or farming accident. But that was one of several adversities that he did face. There's only one image of him that was created from his likeness during his lifetime. And that was a portrait that was painted by Charles Bird King in 1828 while he was in Washington, D.C., negotiating a treaty on behalf of Cherokees. And that painting actually burned in a Smithsonian fire in the 1860s. But before it burned, there was a copy created, which is now hanging in the National Portrait Gallery, and it was painted by Henry Inman. So that's likely the most accurate portrayal there is of Sequoia. and what he would have actually looked like. We don't have many glimpses into his childhood and his early life. There really weren't very many biographies written by people who actually knew him, and he never wrote an autobiography. There is one biography that was written by a cousin of his that did describe him as artistic as a child and that he had creative tendencies. So that gives us a brief glimpse into what he was like early on. But like I said, for someone who is so ingrained in American history and Native American history, there's very little known about him.
Yeah, it's too bad too, because like you said, he's so important to, you know, this country and especially the Cherokee Nation. It's, and one kind of what he's best known for, right, is developing the written form of the Cherokee language. What do we know about what that process was for him? Because I imagine it must have taken a long time and been really arduous. But what do we know about that process?
Today, we estimate that it took him about 12 years to create it.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's hard to pinpoint that exactly, but that's just an estimation. It's important to remember that he had no formal education. And so he was not literate in English. He was not literate in any language when he undertook this challenge. And so it's estimated that as early as 1809, he actually asked one of his cousins to teach him how to write his English name in English. And his English name was George Guess or Gist. I've seen both of them, and they both appear in my family tree. So around 1809 is when he kind of had this thought that, you know, I could write my name in English and now I could maybe learn to write other things. He wanted the Cherokee people to have their own language that they could write in. And so it's estimated that he started to try and create a symbol for every word, which obviously would be a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
And so then he tried, you know, symbols for sentences or, you know, symbols for different letters like the alphabet is in English. But ultimately, he ended up listening to the language. And the Cherokee language is a very unique and a very beautiful language. And there's 86 distinct syllables that make up our language. And so he was able to go in and separate those syllables and create a symbol for each of those syllables, which also made the language easier to learn if you already speak Cherokee, because all you have to do is know, oh, this is the symbol for that syllable. And so now I can read and write that. So, you know, he introduced the language to the Cherokee people in 1821. You know, he'd worked on it for about 12 years at that point is what is estimated. And within a few years, the Cherokee people had a 90% literacy rate, which was astounding for that time period, and it surpassed any other population in the southeastern U.S.
Wow, that is astounding. I feel like even for this time period, that is within a 90% literacy within a few years, you said?
Yes, within a few years.
Yeah. Wow. What do you know? Was there any sort of pushback Sequoia got while developing this, either from members of his own tribe or outside the tribe?
Yeah, there's actually a story that his wife was very upset with all of the time he was devoting to this and set fire to a lot of what he was working on.
Oh, no way.
Yes. So obviously we don't have that recorded, so we don't know that that happened 100%, but that is one of the, I guess, legends surrounding Sequoia. Also in 1821, when he introduced it, so his daughter Ayoka was one of his first students. And so when he went to the town council to kind of introduce what he'd been working on, he took his daughter with him to kind of, you know, obviously you're going to need somebody else to help demonstrate how this is going to work.
Right.
And at first the town council looked at them and saw witchcraft. You know, these symbols, we don't know what these symbols mean. And so they were actually charged with witchcraft and put on trial for it at first. And it was only when Sequoia and his daughter were made to demonstrate, they were put in separate rooms and they were made to demonstrate how they could communicate on these pieces of paper with these symbols to each other from different rooms. And once the council was convinced that, okay, so this isn't witchcraft. These are words. This is language. Then everybody wanted to learn it. Well, you have to teach us. You have to show us how to do this because this is amazing. We've never been able to do this before. So there was some initial pushback, but I would say very soon after people realized what it was actually for, it was very much embraced.
Yeah, it's interesting that being put on trial. I think that attests to the power of language, especially having a written language is to be put on trial for witchcraft.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful thing in and of itself. What did the development of a written language, how did that impact the Cherokee Nation?
Well, the Cherokee Nation, so I guess I could give a little bit of history here. By this time, the Cherokee Nation had already developed a constitution. So now they were able to publish their constitution in their own language. So we adopted a written constitution in 1827. A missionary named Samuel Wooster, who was living among the Cherokees, he in 1827 came up with the idea of adapting Sequoia's written syllabary, because if you look at the original syllabary as it was developed by Sequoia, it looks very different than what you see today, because most of what you see today is printed. And that's also how we learn it now is from the printed form. And the original syllabary, it had a very cursive quality to it. It was very organic looking, very beautiful, but it had to be adapted so they could develop a printing press. And so Samuel Wooster in 1827, he, wrote to the American Board of Commissions for Foreign Missions and said, hey, you know what? I think what we need to do is develop a typeset for this. And so in 1828, he had a printing press there in Georgia, present day Georgia, which is part of where traditionally Cherokees lived. But he got a printing press for them. They developed a typeset. And by 1828, they were publishing the U.S.'s first national bilingual newspaper. Which was the Cherokee Phoenix. The first issue was February 21st, 1828. So I would say it had a profound impact on Cherokees because now they can print their constitution and their laws in their own language. They've got a newspaper. People are learning how to use it. So, they've translated the Bible. They've translated other religious texts, which were extremely important at the time. There was even, we at our National Capital Museum in Tahlequah, we actually have a book on display from the 1840s. It's just a short novella, but it's by a different author, but it was printed in the syllabary. And it was written to be printed in the syllabary. So I would say it had a very profound impact on the Cherokees at the time.
Yeah, in a brief amount of time, it seems as well.
Yes.
Yeah, and you might have to help with some of the dates here, but that was also a tumultuous time. So it was around the time of the Trail of Tears, right? Or that came a little bit after.
It came a little bit after, but yes, the language was really picking up and, the founding of the newspaper and everything, that was about 10 years before the Trail of Tears.
Okay, yeah. So, do you think during that time having a written language to rely on, did that sort of embolden the Cherokee people as they were going through that just horrible, horrible displacement?
I wouldn't necessarily say that it emboldened them, but it certainly informed them. One thing that some people don't understand about the Cherokee removal story is that it didn't just play out in the southeastern United States. It was a story that was reported on as far away as England. So it was a national news story for the time. And so with the capability of their own written language and their own printing press, the Cherokee were able to publish what was happening to them from their viewpoints. And that was being picked up by, you know, other press sources, and it was being published in other newspapers. And so it was a way to get information out, and also to get information not just outside of Cherokee Nation, but to transmit information within the nation itself.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's one thing here at the American Writers Museum that we really appreciate and value, is the ability to tell your own story and make it your own. And so I can only, like what you just said, the ability to tell the world, rest of the world, and their own people what is happening to them without having filtered through another language must have been important to them, I'm sure.
And they did utilize that to the best of their abilities, because the newspapers in the Cherokee Phoenix, they would publish council meeting notes, they would publish the Constitution, they would publish laws that were being passed, but they would also publish essays. And, you know, of course, you know, your other news stories, you know, just small little tidbits. But I think the essays and the publishing of their Constitution and their laws was just profound for that time period. And ultimately, in 1834, the state of Georgia seized their printing press, because it was providing a source for them to get that information out on what was happening to them.
Yeah, that's interesting, because, I mean, that's information is power, right? So I can't believe that. Did they have just the one printing press?
At the time, and I'm not 100% certain, but I believe at the time they only had the one printing press that was in New Echota, Georgia.
Okay, yeah. I want to talk about the Sequoia's Cabin again for a little bit. Do you have any favorite artifacts in there that are especially important to you, whether they're just cool or tell a cool story or really exemplify Sequoia?
Kristen, before she gets started, I'm going to tell you, she will be way too humble when she talks about this. So I'm giving you that lead so you can push her a little bit, because Kristen played a tremendous role in the development, design, and enhancements of all of the exhibits once we acquired the property from the Oklahoma Historical Society.
All right. So don't be humble.
There is no I in team, so... No, I did. Once I found out that we were going to acquire the property, I did request to work on the project, and I ended up working, or I guess being a project lead on the interpretive materials and the artifacts. So we don't have many artifacts that belong to Sequoia. We do have pieces of his plow that were discovered back in the 1930s when they were excavating the property in preparation to build the WPA structure. And so we have those on display. But honestly, my favorite thing about the cabin museum is the cabin itself. It's normally not set up for people to go, I guess, into the cabin and walk around inside the cabin, although we do have it set up where you can step just inside, and then we have a plexi barrier, so you can get the feel that you're in there without being directly inside. But when we acquired the property, I needed to go in and kind of catalog everything that the state had been displaying. And so I got to go inside the cabin. And that was an incredibly surreal experience, because my ancestor built this with his own hands 200 years ago. And now I'm standing in here because I'm going to tell his story. And so that's my favorite part of the museum, is the cabin itself.
Yeah. I love that too. Just give me chills a little bit.
That's the part where she always makes me cry.
Yeah. I understand.
You know, and other people wouldn't even step foot in the cabin, you know, just, I guess, maybe out of superstition, but I was just like, you know what? No, I can't wait to step foot in there.
Yeah. As a descendant of Sequoia, what does his legacy mean to you?
I think that Sequoia's legacy, beyond this monumental accomplishment of developing a written language single-handedly, is one of perseverance. Because when you look at Sequoia's story, he faced great adversity throughout his entire life. He was raised by a single mother. He was lame most of his life, in one of his legs at least. He was illiterate initially. He faced ridicule when he developed this. And ultimately, he moved to the Arkansas Territory. And when he was living there, the Cherokees who were living there in a settlement were then removed from there. So he also faced removal, although it wasn't on the Trail of Tears. So he faced a lot of adversity throughout his life. But I think his biggest legacy is that of perseverance, because he pushed past these challenges and he was able to accomplish something that no other single person in 5,000 years of recorded history has been able to accomplish. And that was to single-handedly develop a written language without first being literate in another language. And I think that that really, in a very real sense, shows us, shows my family as descendants, shows the Cherokee people as his fellow tribes people, and shows people everywhere what is possible when you work hard and you push through that adversity and you are determined to do something. And I think that beyond his accomplishments, that is his legacy.
Yeah, well said. So, like you said, he wasn't literate in any language before the Cherokee language. Did he, after that, did he write at all, as far as any sort of personal writings or letters or official documents or anything like that? Did he have a writing? You said he was creative earlier. Did he also have a little bit of a writer in him as well?
Not that we know of. I know that the Gilcrease Museum in Tulsa has a letter that was supposedly written by him, and they have an example of the syllabary that was written in his own hand for American author John Howard Payne. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, but he was very, I guess you could say, close to the Cherokee Nation. And so he spent some time with Sequoia. And so Sequoia did write out the syllabary, an example for him. And so I would say that's a very precious thing, is that we have that written in Sequoia's own hand with his signature in Cherokee. But other than that, he that we know of, didn't write essays or stories or anything like that. But he did, it's important to remember that even though he did not leave that as a legacy behind him, he had a profound impact on literacy and literature among the Cherokee people. Because, like I said, within a year of its introduction, 90% of the Cherokee people could read and write in Cherokee. They were translating things in Cherokee. They were writing things in Cherokee, their own stories. And so he had a profound impact on literacy and literature, even though he did not leave a designated literary legacy himself, if that makes sense.
It's like he built the foundation for other Cherokee writers to then build a house on, if that metaphor makes sense.
Yes. And just one interesting figure here that I happen to have. So the printing press with the Cherokee typeset, they started using it in 1828, and then they were able to use that from 1828 to 1834. And then there were several years there that they were not operating one. But when they arrived in Indian Territory, they set up a new press. So by 1843, so just between the years of 1828 and 1843, which was the year of Sequoia's death, an estimated 4 million pages were printed using the Cherokee syllabary.
Wow. That's incredible. I wanted to ask too, I think you mentioned it earlier, is the Cherokee language taught in schools today still?
Yes. The Cherokee Nation operates its own immersion school program where children, kindergarten through sixth grade, are taught all of their subjects in Cherokee. But we also have online language classes that are free for anybody to use. Our Cherokee Phoenix newspaper is still in use, and some of the stories are still printed in the syllabary for those who would prefer to read it in Cherokee. And so it's very much still a language that's alive and still taught. And I think that that really says something to his impact on Cherokee Nation, is that, you know, 200 years later, we're still using this invention that he developed. And yes, it's been adapted over time because it had to be adapted for the printing press. And then it later had to be adapted for typewriters. And then it had to be adapted for computers. But today you can go in and change your settings on your iPhone so that everything is displayed in the syllabary. You can go in and change the settings even on your Android. I believe it's even on Google Translate now. And so the Cherokee language is very much still alive, even though, you know, we don't have as many speakers as maybe we would hope to have.
Yeah, and I think that's a testament to similar, like you said, perseverance, how, you know, despite printing presses being taken or, just probably, you know, frowned upon to use the language in public spaces, but still it persisted. It still, like you said, is alive and well today.
Mm-hmm. And next year is actually the bicentennial of when Sequoia introduced the syllabary. Yeah. So throughout the year, we're still working on it, but we're going to be doing some programming in our locations and everything, because this is something that we really want to celebrate, that it's been 200 years since he introduced this to us. And this is such an important part of our identity now.
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't even connect the dots that it, yeah, 2021 would be 200 years. Well, that's exciting. I know Sequoia's death is a little bit of a mystery as well. Is there anything we know about where he died and how he died?
Yes, actually, so in 1842, Sequoia and a small group of people, including his son TC, left the area near Salisaw and headed south towards Mexico, because Sequoia believed that there was a band of Cherokees who had settled down there and he wanted to seek them out. Some people believe that he wanted to bring them back and reunite them, but we don't know for sure. But we do know that he wanted to seek them out and find them. And so if you remember, we're not exactly sure when Sequoia was born, but we believe it was sometime between 1765, 1775, somewhere around in there. So he would have been, by 1842, in his 70s, which is getting up there, especially for that time period.
Yeah,
and sure. So when they traveled south, they were in the Mexican territory when he became ill. And this is according to an account that was published in the Cherokee Advocate, which was our later iteration of the Cherokee Phoenix newspaper, in 1845, when news reached Cherokee Nation of his death. And one of his traveling companions, you know, basically said, this is exactly what happened. So he died in August of 1843 and we buried him here. But unfortunately, nobody's ever been able to locate that spot specifically. So we do know that he became ill and that he unfortunately died in an area where he was buried, and we cannot find that area. Although there have been, you know, of course, expeditions over the years to try and locate it, but that full account was later published in the Cherokee Advocate when news reached the nation of his death.
Is there anything else that, I think that's about all that I have as far as questions go. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover that we didn't cover?
Sure. So Sequoia, in addition to obviously being a scholar, I think it's important to remember about him, he's also a diplomat. He migrated west into the Arkansas Territory and lived among what we now refer to as the Old Settler Cherokee for several years. And when it came time, when Arkansas decided, we want this territory, we would like you to move further west, he traveled to Washington, D.C. with a group of Old Settler leaders and helped negotiate a treaty, which in turn is also when he sat for the only portrait that was painted during his lifetime. So in that treaty that traded the lands that they were occupying in the state of Arkansas for lands in what would become Indian Territory. And those are the lands that are still occupied by Cherokee Nation today. So he was also a diplomat. They resettled in Indian Territory, which he built his cabin in 1829. In 1839 is when all of the groups that had to remove from the East were arriving following the Trail of Tears. And so you have a group of Cherokees that already have an established form of government and they're already settled. They've been here for 10 years. And then you have thousands of people just coming in and trying to resettle. And so in 1839, there was actually a meeting of the leaders from both factions. And they sat down and said, you know, look, we're going to be living here together. And so they signed a formal act of union that unified the old settler Cherokee with the Eastern Cherokee and established a Cherokee nation in Indian Territory. And Sequoyah was one of the leaders who helped broker that agreement. And he was one of the signatories on the agreement. Wow. And so I think that, you know, beyond his legacy as a scholar, I guess, is also his legacy as a diplomat and his critical role in reunifying the Cherokee people and brokering that act of union.
Yeah, that's, yeah, such a pivotal figure in the Cherokee Nation, the liberty and unity. Yeah, quite an incredible life. what's the Cherokee Nation like today? I know you you said you have that immersion school that you mentioned, mm-hmm. all the sites and the museums that you manage or help to manage as well. What do you? So we've talked about the, you know, the past. What do you see as the future for the Cherokee Nation?
I think the future for the Cherokee Nation is very bright. We have over 370,000. Citizens of our tribe worldwide. And the Cherokee story itself is one of perseverance. We've constantly, as a nation, faced adversity, and we've constantly risen from the ashes, which is actually why our newspaper was named the Cherokee Phoenix, because it was the story of the mythological phoenix that rises, he's reborn from the ashes. And so I think the Cherokee Nation has really withstood time in that it has persevered beyond adversity. It has pushed past all of the things that have been thrown its way, removal, assimilation, acculturation. So I think that the future of the Cherokee Nation itself is bright. We are very much still here. We are the largest tribe in North America. And we are here, we are telling our story, we are preserving our culture, we're preserving our language, and I don't believe we have any plans to go anywhere.
Yeah, that's great, well said. Well, I think that's about all that I have for you. I want to thank you, Kristen, again for joining you today, and Whitney, you as well. Thank you for listening to this episode of Nation of Writers, a podcast from the American Writers Museum. We'll see you next month. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The series continues next month with a new episode airing December 30th.